So tonight I'm not going to talk about Zen Mind Beginner's Mind. I'm going to talk about a text called the Shobogenzo Shinjin, which is a collection of koans that Dogen put together. And this is case number one, and it's called Ching Yuan's Whisk. So here's the koan. Zen Master Ching Yuan, who was alive from 660 to 740 in China, once asked Zen Master Shi Dao, 700 to 790, and also Shi Dao wrote the Sandokai, which is emerging a difference in unity, which, Nancy, you probably don't know about, but it's a very famous Zen text. So, Ching Yuan asked Shi Dao, "Where are you from?" And Shi Dao answered, "I am from Xiaozi, where the sixth ancestor Hui Ning taught." Master Ching Yuan held up a whisk and said, "Do you have this at Xiaozi?" Shi Dao said, "Not at Xiaozi, nor in India." Master Ching Yuan pushed Shi Dao by asking, "You haven't been to India, have you?" Shi Dao said, "If I had been there, it would not have been there." The master responded, "If you haven't been there, how can you say that?" Shi Dao said, "Master, you should say something rather than letting me say it all." The master said, "It's not that I mind saying something, but I fear it would be misunderstood later." And then the Denkaroku, which is the transmission of the light, which is another text, said that Ching Yuan hit Shi Dao with a whisk, whereupon Shi Dao experienced a great enlightenment. Okay, so let's take a look at the text here. This, by the way, is in Daido Lori's book that he published of the 300 koans. So, So when Ching Yuan says, "Where are you from?" this is like asking him, you know, what is your essential nature? Who are you? What is your true nature? So say something or do something for me that's going to show me your deepest understanding of who you are and what is the nature of reality. So it's not just some kind of intellectual response to how you understand the absolute or something like that. It's actually a heartfelt expression of your deepest understanding about yourself and your relationship to all of reality, about your understanding about that. So if you know Zen text, this is like the question, who is it that thus comes? And so it's this really deep inquiry. So Ching Yuan is asking him, this is a very classic kind of Zen entrance to a koan, to ask him this question. And so he's saying, can you express this deep understanding? And then Shi Dao says, "I am from Xiaozi, where the sixth ancestor taught." Well, the sixth ancestor is this really famous, important figure in Zen and in China. So for him to say, you know, "I'm from where the sixth ancestor taught," I think is, you know, he's kind of saying, "These are my credentials. This is, you know, this is kind of like where I'm from." But don't be fooled by this, because the sixth ancestor is dead. So Master Ching Yan's response to this was to hold up his whisk. So once again, this is the teacher's way of saying, what's happening in just this moment? What is this, just this? And so then he says, "Well, did I have this at Xiaozi? Do they have this whisk there?" And then Shi Dao says, "Not at Xiaozi and not in India." So I was kind of feeling his oats here. Yeah. So to be honest with you, I'm surprised that Sheikh Nuwad didn't just laugh out loud. You know? It's a kind of absurd answer to say that. Not at Shaoxi, nor in India. But on the other hand, he is kind to Shi Dao, so he continues the dialogue with him. And I don't know whether he's trying to kind of let him hang himself, or whether he's doing it actually as an act of compassion. But I think maybe it's both. So I think what Shi Dao is trying to express in a kind of intellectual affected way is he's trying to point to the absolute. He's trying to say that it doesn't exist in the sense of, when we talk on the Heart Sutra, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue. So he's saying that in the absolute, in the non-dual, it doesn't exist here and it doesn't exist in China. Actually, it doesn't exist anywhere from that point of view. Because nothing exists in its particularity from the point of view of the absolute. So I think that's, you know, what he's trying to say from this kind of, again, this sort of intellectual affected point of view. Not at Shaoxi and not nor in India. So, but you know, he's really off the mark here because kind of doesn't know what he's talking about. So the Dengaroku in the, which is the transmission of the light, and the transmission of the light is a book of succession stories. So it's like it starts out with Buddha, and it goes on through many, many, many generations of the lineage. So this is the story of Shi Dao's Dharma, his transmission of the light, his understanding, his awakening, his enlightenment. So the Dengaroku says, Zen students of recent times fruitlessly run around in the midst of sound and form. Zen students of recent times fruitlessly run around in the midst of sound and form. And that's something, you know, that we do. It's like we just kind of run around. And then we're pulled around by our own emotions, we're pulled around by our passions, we're pulled around by the things that are going on around us. We just get caught up in that kind of whirlwind of activity. And then it says, even if they have memorized the words of the Buddha and the Zen masters and have formulated some way of understanding to cling to, still they have realized nothing. So this is something that I don't know that we memorize the words of the Buddhas and the Zen ancestors, but we certainly attach the teachings. So in this case, you know, they're saying if you just are attached to the words of the teaching, that's a problem. Of course, we have to study the teaching, right? So we use the teaching as a way to understand the nature of what our lives are. But at the same time, we have to experience our life. So at the same time, while the Buddha is talking about something that's both particular and absolute, or the Dharma teachers or the ancestors are talking about that, we have to, like Bodhidharma students, you know, we have to find our place in that. We have to find that particular thing that is our realization that at the same time is expressing all reality. Because all of reality has a place for each thing, right? It's like, it's not like it's a place in the sense of all of reality has some intelligence and they're making room for us, but everything is there unobstructed. Every particularity is rising and falling and part of this whole that we call non-duality, but at the same time there is this particularity. So there is this unobstructed, continuous process of no beginning and end, and yet manifestation in the midst of that, that is who we are, right? We are part of that. So we express our own truth, but that truth that we express in the particularity of who we are is at the same time the truth that is known by all Buddhas and ancestors. So in that way, we do study the words of the Buddha and the Zen ancestors, but we cannot cling to them. We use them like the raft that goes across the river or the ocean so that we reach the other shore, but that other shore that we reach is our own maturity and our own deep understanding that's being manifested in our own time, in our own way. So he says, still, they have realized nothing. That's if we cling to those things, if we don't understand some kind of way in which it is truly about making it our own, right? Then it says, vainly squandering the donations of the faithful all your lives, in the end, when you have to swallow a bitter pill, you surely have many regrets. The way I see this one is this vainly squandering the donations of the faithful all your lives. The whole world wants us to wake up. That's the donation of the faithful. The donation of the faithful is the continuous practice of all beings that allows and enables us to be here, enables us our life as we enable the lives of others. So in this way, we have this deep responsibility, this deep compassion, this deep connection to the donations of the faithful, which is this practice of the trees, and the practice of other people, and the practice of the oceans, and the practice of the fish, and the practice of the zafus and zavakans, the practice of anything that you can think of, that is this great continuous practice, which is our reality, which is reality itself. So we don't want to vainly squander that effort of all being that is faithful to us, that is generous to us, as we are faithful and generous in return, hopefully. So that's, I think, our responsibility in our practice. So in some ways, our practice is about alleviation of the suffering that we experience, but by experiencing no self, dropping body and mind, and alleviating that suffering of the self, we also alleviate the suffering of others. And we alleviate that obstruction that keeps us from the realization of this deep interconnection that we have. So that deepest vow that we have is, I think, ought to be a kind of acknowledgement of this faithful devotion, the donations of the faithful. And then he says, in the end, when you have to swallow a bitter pill, you'll surely have many regrets. So this is that bitter pill of not having practiced. This is this bitter pill of not having truly found that connection. This bitter pill of not having found our place in the midst of our realization in the midst of this life that we live. And then, of course, when we have those regrets, what can be done? But, on the other hand, that moment of waking up is the totality of our life. So he says, Ching Yuan says, well, you haven't been to India, have you? So, you know, it's a really interesting give and take because Xin Yang starts out in this place of the Zen master doing, you know, who are you, where do you come from, this is my whisk, to bringing it right down to this everyday interaction. So he starts out in this place of, can you show me your understanding? Can you do something as a Zen student? Can you do something in which you really express your understanding in this moment? And Shi Dao isn't able to do that. So Ching Yuan says to himself, I guess, okay, we're just going to have this dialogue. But the thing about it is I think he's trying to bring Shi Dao back to this real concrete life, right? He's trying to take him out of this heady trip that he's into about some kind of notions that he has, that he's expressing himself in some deep way with this kind of nonsense, actually. On the other hand, it takes a lot of clay to make a Buddha. And Shidao ended up being a very great Buddha. So this is a great, very great Buddha expressing himself in a really foolish way. So there's hope for all of us. So Shidao says, Ching Yuan says, "You haven't been to India, have you?" And then Shidao says, "If I had been there, it would not have, if I had been there, it would not have been there." That's really, what bluster, you know, what technique, you know, what great expression of the Absolute is this? How could his I, how could his bombastic I, you know, usurp the truth of reality? How could he say that if I had been there, it would not have been there? What is he thinking? What is he thinking that he's saying here? But on the other hand, isn't this eye of delusion also the truth? Is there ever a time that we can be outside the truth of reality? Is there ever a time that even in the midst of our delusion, we are not a part of reality itself? So while he may not be expressing his true nature, he cannot help but express his true nature. It's just some ideas that he has are getting in the way, that are obstructing his ability to express himself. So then Ching Yuan says, well, if you haven't been there, how can you say that? So this is really just on this very everyday level, you know. Sit down and have some tea, young man, you know. So then Shidao says, well, Master, you should say something rather than letting me say it all, which is really quite funny. So, Master, you should, like, you know, step in here, step up to the plate. Ching Yuan, you know, it's like, come up here and, like, go to bat and let's have this Dharma combat with each other, you know. But what he doesn't realize is that they are having a Dharma combat the whole time. So, but on the other hand, it might be that he's realized that somehow he's missing the mark. So he's realizing that he's kind of been backed into a corner, and there's nothing more that he can say. So he's a smart guy. So maybe he's saying, what gives here? The master's not really saying anything. He just keeps asking me where I'm coming from. The Denka Roku says about this, having met and talked like thus, if they both transmitted a half, how could the whole thing be said? So, if what Shidao is saying is true, there is some implication here that he's saying it all, or that if the master chimes in, it's going to be like half and half, right? So having met and talked thus, if they both transmitted a half, how could the whole thing be said? So they're saying, you know, just think about the possibility, or just think about this idea that if they both contribute half, does that make a whole? Even if the universe crumbles and the whole essence is exposed alone, this is still only halfway. Even this point is arrived at on one's own without depending on the arts of another. Needless to say, advancing a step beyond the halfway point, subtly conveying a secret message, doesn't depend upon anything at all. So he's saying here, even if the universe crumbles and the whole essence is exposed alone, this is still only the halfway. And then he says, even this point is arrived at on one's own without depending on the arts of another. So they're saying that our understanding, while it is, I think, in dialogue, using the word dialogue as a metaphor or figurative way of speaking, which means that dialogue can also be the actual things that we do, not the things we say, right? A dialogue of essence as opposed to a dialogue of the mind, our understanding is still arrived at on our own. The deepest understanding, the true realization that we have, is a realization that we arrive at on our own. We have help because this is an interconnected event that we're engaged in, this life that we're engaged in. So actually all of reality wants us to wake up. Those faithful devotees want us to wake up. And our teachers want us to wake up. And our friends want us to wake up. Everything wants us to wake up. But ultimately, our waking up, all the pointing at the moon and the go here, go that we engage in, that's our own effort. That's our own realization that brings us back to turning the light inward, that brings us back to some realization of our own true situation. And only we can have that realization. It can't be done for us. And so even this point is arrived at on one's own without depending on the arts of another. Needless to say, advancing a step beyond the halfway point, subtly conveying a secret message, doesn't depend upon anything at all. So this going beyond the halfway point, which in this case, I think they're saying that even if the master spoke his truth, it's still not the whole thing. Because it's about some kind of verbal expression. And sometimes a verbal expression is an expression of the totality of what's happening. But in this case, I would say it was not. Okay? In this case, it would be like Xing Yuan speaking to the air somehow. Xing Yuan would not be actually able to communicate with Shi Dao in his state of mind, because he's so caught in what he's doing. So really, the only thing that Xing Yuan can do is sort of say, whoa, bub, back up, come back down, you know, come back to reality, put your feet on the ground. What are you talking about? Have you ever been to India? So, but the secret message is not a secret at all, because it is all revealed to us every day in every moment. And it doesn't depend on anything at all. And then the master says, it's not that I mind saying something, but I fear it would be misunderstood later. He's saying, well, I could say something, but I don't think you're going to understand it. And if you do understand it, your interpretation of what you think you heard is going to be misunderstood. So you're going to filter what I'm saying through your own understanding at this point, and it's not going to be really very helpful. Then Kuroku says, how can someone else know? It is simply that it has always been inherent in oneself. Therefore, even if you speak of pain and bitterness, if the other has no experience of pain piercing his bones, or of bitterness splitting his tongue, in the end there is no way to convey it. So how can someone else know? How does someone else know? How do we know? How do we really understand unless we walk in that person's shoes? So even our empathy comes from some place of having walked in another person's shoes, some place of a willingness to experience what this other person has experienced. Even if we don't have the specificity of that particular thing, that we can go with them to a certain extent. Like, I don't know what it's like to have cancer, but I do know what it's like to be afflicted with other things. So I can say, I can understand it to this place, so I have empathy for you, and I can understand that I don't understand it completely. And so that even builds greater empathy. So this way in which we have to be able to find our own truth, but the way we find our own truth is through this interconnected reality of being able to connect with the other as well. So it says, how can someone else know? It is simply that it has always been inherent in oneself. So when we truly open up to the nature of ourself, we're also able to experience the nature of the other as well. Yet at the same time, if we obstruct that connection with our preconceived ideas, with all the things that get in the way, with the kind of static, then it's not going to happen. Then we're not going to be able to see it. And I think that's, you know, that's what's happening here in this dialogue, is that Qing Yuan is trying to break through. Qing Yuan is trying to offer this opportunity, and Shi Dao is so caught in his own kind of trip that he's doing, he doesn't realize what's going on. But at the very end, of course, Qing Yuan hits Shi Dao with a whisk. So, and then Shi Dao experienced a great enlightenment. So that's saying something, right? So Shi Dao says, "Oh, don't let me say it all." Qing Yuan says, "It's not that I mind saying something, but I fear it would be misunderstood later." And then he whacks him up the side of the head with a whisk. And that's what wakes him up, because finally the light dawns, because that's that experience of completely having this moment of right now. So at that moment of being hit by the whisk, all the intellect, all the dialogue, all the stuff flies out the window. And Shi Dao is right at that place where being hit by the whisk wakes him up. Oftentimes we get hit by the whisk, but we don't wake up. But somehow, in that moment, Qing Yuan was able to know that that was the time. That was the time to hit him with the whisk. And sometimes you can tell. I'll say as a teacher, you know, there are times when you know that the person is ripe to hear this thing. They're ripe to kind of get knocked off their pedestal. To have their notion of, probably shouldn't say knocked off the pedestal, have their notion about just to turn it a little bit. Just to say it in such a way that the person, be presented to them in a way they hadn't thought of before. That kind of like completely blows them. Blows their preconceived idea about this. So it's like that's what's happening here, is he's just knocking him right out of this place that he's in by hitting him. So of course I don't walk around smacking guys. But there are times when we'll say something to each other that is just knocking us off this position that we're on, waking us up to a different point of view. And that's a kind of epiphany, if the time is right. So I think our job as students is also to keep ourselves awake to that moment, keep ourselves awake to the possibility of that moment. Because those faithful, devoted practitioners are always trying to wake us up. Reality is always trying to wake us up. So if we don't have all this stuff going on in our heads, you know, stuff like, well, we probably don't walk around saying there's no whisk in India, but we have our own version of that. We either have our own version of a kind of delusion about the nature of reality, which comes from our likes and dislikes and our judgments, or we have our own idea about what the teachings are that are more about, I would say in this case, they're more about aggrandizing the self. But sometimes we have our own version of teachings that's about tearing ourselves down. We have some version of the teaching that is not helpful to us. So that's what, you know, that's what we're trying to wake up to. So the Dengar Roku says that Qing Yuan beat the grass to frighten the snakes away. He beat the grass to frighten the snakes away. The Dengar Roku goes on to say, when at the blow of the whisk he realized the fact of being, he both forgot himself and also knew himself. So when he realized the fact of being, so when he was fully present. He knew his true nature, and at the same time, he forgot his selfishness. So he knew his true nature, and at the same time, this kind of thing that he was doing dropped away. He came to life in the midst of death, the death being the death of this attachment that he had, and the life being the true life of being present for what was happening at that moment. And in the dark, his true eye was illuminated. I think there's some interesting things about this, that Qing Yuan is actually being very compassionate. And Xi Dao is being very dense, but we are also very dense. And Xi Dao is turned out to be quite an amazing teacher and wrote some amazing things that we're all still studying. So, as I said earlier, even when we maybe make a fool of ourselves in the Dharma, or we try to express ourselves in ways that maybe are really off the mark, it's also important to express ourselves. It's also important to just say it. It's also important to just engage, you know, to just put ourselves out there and see what happens. So Xi Dao just put himself out there. And it is true, he ended up getting smacked up the side of the head with a whisk. And sometimes we put ourselves out there and the situation or reality kind of knocks us around a little bit. But actually that's where often we find our greatest wisdom, is when we get knocked around. And I don't mean, you know, in an abusive way. But life knocks us around. Life throws us challenges. Sometimes we respond skillfully and with wisdom and compassion, and sometimes we don't. But every time we learn something, and every time if we pay attention and we're awake, it brings us right back to the moment. It brings us right back to the reality of our lives. So if we get very ill, let's say, and no matter how many stories we have about that illness, the reality is that this is our life. So we have a lot of stories about cancer in our culture. Right, we have a lot of, like, cancer is somehow some kind of what? You didn't eat the right things. Or you did this, or you did that. But the reality is this thing is happening to you right in this moment. So we want to drop all the stories. We want to drop all the stories as the person observing. We want to drop all the stories and just say, how can I help? What do you need? Can I be present with you in this reality right now? In this very concrete way? And if we have the illness, we want to drop all the stories about shoulds or should or all things, but just like, okay, this is what's happening right now. And I think that's the thing about getting really sick, for example, or about having something really huge like that happen, is that it does. It pulls us right back into the present moment. There's no getting away from it. There's no hiding. We are felled, in a way, by this, where we cannot protect ourselves in a certain way. And there's a deep opening and a deep kind of wisdom, I think, if we can meet that experience where it is. So we don't have to wait to get cancer. We don't have to wait to be dying. We can actually meet our lives right now in this moment. Or driving our car, going to the grocery store, going to work, whatever it is, having relationships, whatever the thing is, we can actually meet our lives. So this is a story, I think, about a young man who's meeting his life in relationship, which we do, of course, all the time. Everything is in relationship, even though we don't think of it that way, but the reality is everything we do, every moment, every breath, every step, everything is in relationship. But here it actually is, you know, person to person kind of relationship, immediate kind of feedback in that way. So, and Xi Dao, you know, he fumbled around and stumbled around and finally met the moment. So that's good. It's a good thing. There's hope here. Thank you very much. Do you have any? Should we have tea?
Yes. Well, I have a number of comments, if I can remember them all. Oh, the one is when they were having a conversation, and it's, you can't, there aren't words for it. So if they, regardless of how much each of them said, even if it was half, and even if it was, they said it all, it still wouldn't be.
That's right.
It.
That's right. Yes.
This just shoots out?
No, you click the button and then you can pour it out. Click that and that opens it and then you can pour it out.
Oh, I see.
My understanding of this is that to truly experience reality itself, it is something actually more than the things in this case that are being said, obviously. But it's something about, in this particular case, I think there might be a time, I think there is a meeting that totally does express it completely, but it's not in the words that are happening here. So there is something that's completely being expressed. You know, Dogen says even in our partial expression, it is a complete expression. Because it can never be less than a complete expression of where we are right now. It's not possible. In that way, it's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yet at the same time, something might be lacking.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I wanted to say was, about sort of the being ready to hear something, being ready to hear something, and being open to it and able to take it in. I know that there are times when I've heard you say something, and all of a sudden, I know I've heard it before. But all of a sudden, I get it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's that being ready, being open and being ready to
receive that. Yeah, it's like a cumulative process.
Mm-hmm.
Because you probably know this from therapy. It's like you told your client something over and over again, and then they come in one day and say, oh, so-and-so said such and such, right? And it's like you're thinking to yourself, haven't I said that about 15 times already? You know, now this other person is being attributed, you know?
Exactly.
But it's like, you know, it's because all that cumulative effort that you put into it came to a fruition in that
mm-hmm.
moment, you know? And it's like, that's when we have to let go of the self and just say, well, I'm really glad that that person got that piece of information, you know? But that there is this groundwork that's being laid. And it's all kind of happening and percolating away, and then at some point, bang, it's like something happens
mm-hmm.
and it clicks.
And I wonder, why didn't I get that before? Why is it so all of a sudden it's like this aha, you know,
when
it wasn't before, it wasn't. It was
because,
just listening.
Yeah, because it's something, who knows,
an
inevitable event in our psyche and reality coming together with that.
Yeah.
Yes.
You talked about the student's kind of job is to be ready or to. Could you talk more on that? I mean, how does that look?
I think it's a kind of sincerity. I think we just bring our sincere selves to the process, and I think that's it. You know, we just bring our hearts to it. And we show up, and we ask our questions and we see what happens. You know? And out of that, I think it will happen.
You're kind of talking about faith there. And,
mm-hmm. Yes, it is a kind of faith. I'm really interested in Francis Cook, who is a Buddhist scholar. He's dead now. I'm pretty sure he is. He has several translations of Dogen, and one of them is called The Hoofprints of the Ox. I think that's the name of it. And he has great introductions to these sections. And in this book, he talks about, in his introduction, he talks about faith. He talks about a Buddhist faith in juxtaposition to other kinds of faith. But the thing he says about Buddhist faith is that in Buddhism, what we have faith in should be, over time, proven to be true. In the sense that, like for example, I've talked about this before, but example, the Four Noble Truths. We have faith. If I say to you, the suffering is caused by clinging, or we read that, you know, that's what the Buddha said, then there's this way in which we take that on faith. Right? Mm-hmm. Because usually when we're suffering, when we first start out, we don't think it's because we're clinging to something. Usually when we're suffering, our tendency is to want to blame somebody else or say, you know, so our faith is that actually it is within us and not within the other. Okay. Right? So our faith in that case would be that I am clinging to something that is causing suffering to myself and possibly to others. So then the teaching is that when you let go of that clinging, you are freed from suffering. So, but it's really hard to let go of the clinging. It's really hard to take responsibility. And that hard work has to partly be motivated by faith. And then, as we engage in that process, we find out that it's actually true. Right? At least that's been my experience. So faith in Buddhism is not faith in something that you actually cannot prove to be true. So there is this, the Buddha said, you know, don't leave your mind behind. Don't leave your discriminating mind, not discriminating in the sense of likes and dislikes, but discerning. Don't leave your discernment behind. But at the same time, you have to have faith. And you have to have faith in order to be able to actually engage in the practice. Because if you truly knew it, you wouldn't have to do the practice, right? If you really understood it, intellectually it may make sense to you, but you have to do the practice. You have to engage in the practice in a non-intellectual point of view. And that takes faith, wouldn't you say? And so that's what he says the difference is. We're not having faith in something that ultimately we can't see. We're not having faith in something that is never proven to be true. But that we're having faith in this teaching that should become apparent to us at some point to us. And then as that reveals itself and it seems to make sense, then maybe you're willing to go a step further into some, you know, something else. But my own experience for myself anyway is that the places where I go into faith at this point in my practice, it all makes sense to me. I may not be able to completely experience it, but I understand that what I have faith in, it makes sense to me that it is really real. It's out there, or in here, or both. But it's not really something abstract.
I think, too, when, for me anyway, acknowledging and understanding my suffering coming from my own choices or how I look at things or how I feel about things, when I really look at that, then the suffering is much less. It's mm-hmm. like, oh, yeah, you know, I have choices here, and this is not due to somebody else doing something to me or a situation, you know. This is that my suffering is coming from myself. Mm-hmm. And it really changes then, that suffering.
Yeah, and that's the idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we have that faith that that's,
faith
that that's true. And then we do it and we find out, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I get this.
I have a story about the whisk.
Okay, let's hear it.
One time I said to my brother, I said...
Her brother is a Rin Zazen teacher.
I said, what's the whisk for? Because I was impressed with this whisk that was held during a ceremony.
Bang.
Ceremonies. Oh. And it's a horsehair, is it?
Something traditionally, yeah.
White, with this elegant white flowing hair thing on a stick. And so during ceremonies, the doshi carries it around and does different things with it. I said to my brother, what's the significance of the whisk? He said, it's to swat flies. He always, whenever I ask him something I think has some really deep meaning, he just like zap, you know.
Then she got to find the key.
Yeah, right.
Even his own sister.
Even his own sister. Yeah.
Is he younger or older?
2 years older.
Yeah. Older brothers are always tyrannizing younger sisters.
Even his and
that's right.
Roshis.
That's right.
He's stepping down.
Yeah, you said that. He's been doing it for a long time, huh?
He started studying with Suzuki Roshi. So, really long time.
Well, maybe if he ever comes here.
I know.
We could have him give a talk. Actually, it'd be nice for him to come on Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would.
Just because there'd be more people here, it'd be nice for him to give a talk. You can give a good rousing Rinzai TV show. Well, are we done?
Sure.
I got it all.
Well, we're never done.
Yeah.
You know, we forgot to...